Justice, Justice Sykes, was sworn in. And so you now have a very experienced court in this courtroom and a very experienced bench, since this, I think, is our ninth case together. With that said, we will turn to our last case of the September oral arguments, 98-1343, Margaret Sofa versus Owens Corning Fiberglass Corporation. Bruce A. Ranta will argue on behalf of Margaret Sofa. Mr. Ranta.
Thank you and good afternoon. My name is Bruce Ranta, along with Jennifer Seeloff. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Margaret Sofa, who is here with us today, and the estate of Robert Sofa, her deceased husband. This case is here on a certification from the Court of Appeals on a dismissal at the trial court level on statute of limitations grounds. This case presents a conflict between the discovery rule on the one hand and the single injury rule on the other. After summarizing briefly a few of the important facts, I would like to explain to the court how the dismissal of this action violates the discovery rule and its underpinnings in a manner that offends the most basic notions of justice, fairness, and common sense, while at the same time failing to fairly promote the policies upon which the single injury rule is based, a fact that has been recognized and addressed by nearly every court that has considered the precise issue presented here. Briefly, the factual background is this. Starting at age 18 and for the rest of his adult working life, Mr. Sofa was employed as an asbestos worker, now more commonly referred to as an insulator. Throughout the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s, he was exposed to asbestos-containing products on a virtual daily basis during the construction of new buildings, primarily here in the Madison, Wisconsin area. He retired in 1995 at the age of 62. The following year, in December of 1996, he was diagnosed with malignant mesothelioma, a cancer of the lining of the lung. Malignant mesothelioma is what is sometimes referred to as a signal tumor. When a doctor makes a diagnosis of mesothelioma, virtually the first question he or she asks the patient is, where were you exposed to asbestos? It is that uniquely associated with that mineral that the doctor will ask that question. This particular disease has a latency period of 30 years or more. That is, from the time of exposure until the time of diagnosis. There's no cure for the disease. It is invariably fatal. There are various treatments that are attempted to prolong survival, which were done in this case, that the most current of those treatments involve removal of a lung, a series of chemotherapy treatments, and a series of radiation treatments. Mr. Sofa underwent those treatments. He survived another 11 months, which is about average. Before he died, he filed this suit in March of 1997, 3 months after his diagnosis. This action was dismissed at the trial court level because in the 1980s, Mr. Sofa had been diagnosed with a pleural condition that is also caused by exposure to asbestos. There is no medical connection between his cancer and that earlier pleural condition. The cancer is not a consequence of that pleural condition. It's not a maturation of that condition. It is a separate and distinct disease. This fact is undisputed. And although there is no connection between those two diseases, the trial court dismissed this action and indicated that it felt bound by the single injury rule here in Wisconsin, and that to rule otherwise would be to make a policy choice that it felt was inappropriate to do at the trial court level. I would submit to this court that there are two competing policies at play here, and that to rule either way is to make a policy choice. And that in this particular case, the unique circumstances of this case, the discovery rule far outweighs the policies underlying the single injury rule. As the members of this court are aware, this court adopted the discovery rule in 1983 in the Hansen versus A.H. Robbins case. That rule was adopted in the interest of justice and fundamental fairness, the court noting in that decision that it would be manifestly unjust for the statute of limitations to begin to run before a claimant could reasonably become aware of the injury. That case has been followed consistently in a series of decisions where this court and the Court of Appeals has reaffirmed the common sense notion that it would be fundamentally unfair to bar a claim before the injury could ever be discovered. And yet, that is exactly what the trial court ruling in this case did. In the 1980s, Bob Sofa could not have known he would get cancer in 1996. There is nothing he could have done to have discovered that fact. There is nothing he could have done to have avoided that fact. He could not have sought any relief in the 1980s for that subsequent condition. Now, the trial court indicated in its decision that it felt bound by the single injury rule, despite the policies of the discovery rule, and I would suggest that the trial court ruling is neither dictated by the single injury rule, nor does it fairly promote the policies underlying that rule. If I can take those in reverse order, the policies that underpin the single injury rule are often categorized similar to a statute of limitations in the sense that it promotes finality, it promotes judicial economy, and it prevents stale claims. Number one, the trial court ruling in this case will not prevent any stale claims of mesothelioma. By definition, and the nature of that disease, all mesothelioma claims are stale. The disease has a 30-year latency period. Upon diagnosis, the person must go back 30 years in time, look at the actions of the manufacturers of asbestos at that time, and determine if they were appropriate. He must prove exposure. He must look back in time and attempt to do so in a way that is very difficult. The case is stale by definition.
Mr. Rano, let me, if I might, interrupt for a minute. Why is the single injury rule applicable here if you take the approach that the diagnosis of your client in the late 70s or early 80s was a diagnosis not of an injury, but rather of a condition that really was not subject to treatment?
That is an approach that some jurisdictions have taken, and I guess I can't necessarily disagree with that position, although I don't think that issue is presented to the court here today, and I don't think there is sufficient evidence of the record for this court to make that determination.
Well, it is touched on in your opposing counsel's brief.
Correct. They do touch upon that, and there have been courts that have adopted the so-called two-disease rule, in other words, ruling that a subsequent cancer is unrelated to some earlier condition, such as a pleural condition, is not barred, and then have taken in a subsequent case that additional step that you are suggesting, and that is ruling that certain pleural conditions are not an injury such that it would trigger the statute of limitations or entitle the individual to any sort of relief.
When your client was diagnosed with the pleural condition, was there any treatment offered to him? Were there any expenses tied into that diagnosis?
This kind of predates my involvement, and so I don't know all of the details of that. My understanding is that he was diagnosed by chest x-ray in either the late 70s or early 80s. During that period of time, some unions, for example, the Insulators Union in particular, would run chest x-rays on their members to determine if they had any sort of asbestos-related disease because they knew they were at a heightened risk for it. I am not aware of any treatment that he underwent other than continued chest x-rays.
He sued, didn't he?
He did file a claim. That is correct.
There was a dismissal, right?
There was a dismissal upon plaintiff's voluntary motion to dismiss that case.
But it was dismissed with prejudice.
It was.
So it was a dismissal on the merits.
It was a dismissal with prejudice with respect to that condition. That's correct.
Okay. Now, suppose that suit had continued. Maybe my understanding is wrong, but my understanding is that you would not show loss of wages because of this condition. You wouldn't show necessarily pain and suffering. Is that right? Would not show? Or would show?
That, I guess that's subject
might
to debate.
Might show. Okay.
Right.
But there would be expenses, and that is for future medical care. That is, you'd have to go more frequently to the physician and get x-rays, and if I understand this.
I think that would be about the extent of it.
Right. But you could recover from that in a tort case.
Yes, I think possibly you could.
And then the question would be, is could you, since you now know you're affected by asbestos, you might or might not get a malignancy, right?
Right.
Is there any showing that more people will get a malignancy if they have this pleural condition than if they don't have the pleural condition?
Not to the required level for recovery.
Okay, so you're saying they couldn't have recovered for this?
Under the state of the law in Wisconsin, as I understand it, and in most other jurisdictions, he could not have recovered in the 1980s for a risk of getting cancer in the future.
Because it's an anxiety without a probability.
Exactly.
As shorthand.
And based on the ruling in the Miracle case.
I was trying to think, and I didn't come up with anything, but maybe you could tell us of some other examples where you might have a condition or a disease for which you'd seek damages, and that maybe later you'd have a second condition or a disease. Because what I'm worried about, counsel, is obviously that it's hard to just have an asbestos rule.
Well, I guess I would disagree to a certain extent there, because as this court noted, I believe last May in the Wausau Tile case, in which the court was discussing the previous Northridge case, the court specifically noted that asbestos presents unique challenges to the court, and that courts generally view these cases as unique in the law. I believe the Northridge case itself, in fact, did design a rule
that was the building.
Sure, it was a property damage case, correct, in the building. But the rule that was fashioned in that case was specifically designed to address the unique aspects of asbestos and the problems it creates. In that case, a property damage situation, which we're not dealing with here, but asbestos creates those kinds of problems.
That's why I'm asking you these questions, because since we're talking about medicine, I have this feeling that there are going to be other cases that are like this, and that you can't distinguish asbestos.
Well, I mean, I guess I can't say that.
What about fiberglass?
I don't know. I don't know the medicine involved. I'm not aware of extensive or really hardly any litigation regarding fiberglass. I've seen medical studies which suggest perhaps a connection, but I guess I can't say to the court here there is no possibility that there won't be some substance which creates multiple disease processes that someone would come in later and argue this rule should apply to. I can't.
Is that what you're asking for, a special asbestos exception to the single injury rule?
I don't think that this a ruling in the favor of the plaintiffs here is an exception to the single injury rule, but to the extent there is any concern that it is, I think the court could make very clear in its decision that this is a ruling that applies only to an asbestos case.
And why don't you think it's an exception?
To the single injury rule?
Right.
I think the cases that have been cited by the defendant are distinguishable and do not truly involve a situation involving two separate and distinct diseases, that they really are single injuries, and this case is something different. For example, the cases kind of fall into two categories. There's the first category, which involves, for example, the Olson case involving the blood transfusion, and the Keith Pop case, which involved the DES situation. In both of those cases, the plaintiff had a child which then died, in one case prematurely and then died, which was related to either the blood transfusion or the DES. At that point in time, the plaintiff knew that she had been damaged and that her ability to have healthy children in the future had been damaged. And she knew at that point in time that if she had further children, she ran the very significant risk. We don't know exactly the percentage risk involved from the cases that I can determine, but she knew that there was a significant risk that she would not have a healthy child. And so it is a single injury, I think, with consequences that could be predicted. And it is also a case where the consequences could be avoided. It's perhaps not a fair choice to the women involved in that case, but they did know that if they attempted to have future children, they were running that risk. Here, there's nothing Bob Sofa could have done in the 1980s to have avoided the consequence here. There's just simply nothing he could have done. The other category of cases under the single injury rule, I think, are distinguishable because the plaintiff really could have learned the full extent of his or her injury at the time. The plaintiff or the defendants cite a series of cases, the Bank One case involving the asbestos in the building down in Milwaukee, where the bank knew for years there was asbestos in the building. When they went to remodel one of the floors in the building, they learned there was going to be additional costs involved because of the precautions. At that point in time, they knew, or they should have known, that when they went to remodel the rest of the building, there were going to be additional costs. I mean, they knew or could have known the full extent of their injury at that point. The other cases, I think, are fall into a similar category. This is not a true single injury case. And if I can expand on that a little bit and touch on the claim preclusion issue, I think that really highlights why this is not a true single injury case.
Before you do that, I'm wondering what, if anything, can be borrowed from asbestosis cases and workers' comp. I mean, for years, asbestosis cases have been multiple dates of injury cases. As an occupational disease. Is there anything to be borrowed from the multiple dates of injury line of cases for occupational diseases, including asbestosis or maybe just asbestosis and workers' comp, that correlates to this?
Not that I can see. The workers' comp cases revolve around who was the employer. And in cases like this, someone like Mr. Sofa frequently has multiple employers. Tradespeople generally do. They work for a lot of different contractors. And so the workers' comp system has attempted to wrestle with the question of which employer should be responsible. So they've gone through this analysis of dates of injury.
They emphasize which employer because that's liability and that's money.
Right.
But they also discuss that there are can be, with an injury, a new exposure and a new injury with regard to the same condition. I mean, there is a Zurich General accident case, and I don't expect you to know that right off hand, but there are a number of, you know, workers' comp cases dealing with occupational hazards. Let's see, if the disability is a partial disability and then recovery can go to a certain date, but then it might be necessary for the commission to determine whether the subsequent disability arose from a recurrence or is due to a new onset induced by subsequent exposure. I mean, that happens all the time. New date of injury because there's a new exposure and a new injury.
I guess I haven't really thought of it in those terms, and I do think it really is quite a bit different in the situation. And it is a situation now, unfortunately. There really aren't new exposures anymore. I mean, asbestos ceased being used widely in about 1973, 74, in that time period. So many of the people we're dealing with now had their exposures in the 50s and 60s, and not currently. If I could, as I indicated, I would like to just touch briefly on the claim preclusion issue because I think that really highlights the tension here. If this were truly a single injury case, then it should also be barred by the doctrine of claim preclusion because Mr. Sofa did file a claim back in the 1980s, and therefore the claim preclusion rule should bar this claim.
Was the dismissed action.
In the 1980s. But claim preclusion requires that the claim was either previously litigated or could have been litigated. And in every one of the cases cited by the defendants in their brief, the court specifically references that requirement, that the transactional analysis of the defendants go through is not enough. The claimant must have been able, could have litigated his claim previously. Now, the trial court in this case correctly pointed out that Mr. Sofa could not have litigated his mesothelioma claim in the 1980s. It was not a claim that he could have predicted, that was reasonably certain to occur. Pursuant to the court's decision in Miracle, it was simply a possibility. It is a contradiction to then say that even though he could not have brought this claim before its diagnosis, that he's now barred by the statute of limitations because it had to be brought before diagnosis. It's a perfect catch-22. It creates an impossibility.
And that goes back to the single injury and the statute of limitations issue.
Correct.
And I've been trying to think of an example. Let's take an auto accident, and you're injured and your leg is broken. But unbeknownst to everybody, your heart muscle has also been weakened. But nobody knows it. Nobody picks it up. So you sue, and you get your leg injury damages. Or you can voluntarily dismiss because you've been paid by medical. Your meds have been paid, and you don't care about anything else. Either way. Then, 5 or 6 years, or 8 or 10, beyond the statute of limitations, you find this heart muscle weakened, and it's been, we have to pretend, causal connection is clearly proved to this auto accident. What shall we do about this heart damage? Can we go back and sue the driver?
I think the asbestos situation is so unique that is a hypothetical that I just don't think we can apply.
The theory is the same. I know that asbestos is different than other things, but the theory, you don't know the injury.
Right.
It's beyond the statute of limitations. You've had a lawsuit. You couldn't have claimed it in that lawsuit because you didn't know. I mean, I could give you another example of a medical doctor maltreating the leg, and you don't know that. You could sue the medical doctor maybe later, but you're suing them both at the same time.
I guess the hypothetical presumes or assumes that the condition existed as a result of the auto accident.
Yes.
Not couldn't be discovered.
Right.
Just simply couldn't be discovered.
Just won't show up for 10 years because the muscle has been damaged, but no symptoms. Just like this. You've got a hidden defect in that body, right?
Well,
latent.
This is a late disease situation, obviously. There are some parallels, and I think maybe you'd have to look at that case if that were the factual situation, and they truly were, as you've outlined it here, a situation that couldn't be discovered.
I think we're going to find that with drugs. You take a drug, may have side effects, you may sue for it, you may not, and then find out later that the drug has a very significant effect.
Well, if it's a situation, whereas here that it's an entirely separate and distinct disease process that's occurring, you'd have to look at that. But if it's a situation where it's a single disease that simply matures and the consequences show up later, I think the single injury rule applies.
Is my heart example a single disease or not?
I think you'd have to look at the medicine involved there.
Well, I'm pressing you because I think that it's very difficult to move in from single disease not. I think those are conclusions to get to a result.
Sure, I understand.
Not
it
that
is.
Courts haven't done it.
Right. It's not a clear cut distinction. I would agree.
Do you think that the public policies here for giving a remedy to someone who is so severely injured without his or her fault and did everything right in terms of the statute of limitations, you think that balances out against the competing policy of the statute of limitations and claim preclusion?
I think it outweighs those considerations as reflected by the adoption and creation of the discovery rule by this court and the courts that have consistently followed that. And I think the majority of other jurisdictions that have faced this very precise issue have agreed. that virtually every court that's considered this issue in other jurisdictions have found that the policies supporting the discovery rule and the fundamental unfairness that occurs if someone's claim is barred before it's ever discovered or could be discovered outweigh the considerations that support the single injury rule. And I would urge the court to follow that example, as it did in Northridge, and to do the same in this case and join that majority.
Well, one of the things you said was that you thought that there should be no lawsuit allowed on the plural condition.
Well, that's something I said in response to Justice Crook's question that some jurisdictions have done, and that is something based upon the medicine involved, the record at that time. That is a possibility.
Then that gets rid of claim preclusion as an issue. Does it get rid of the statute of limitations as an issue?
It would in a case involving simply a diagnosis of pleural thickening, for example. If that were a non-compensable, non-injury, I think it would couldn't trigger a statute of limitations.
Well, what about, isn't there a statute of limitation? Maybe it's a statute of repose in this state that limits the discovery rule for medical malpractice. Maybe it's only medical malpractice.
There is a statute of repose in medical malpractice actions that this court has addressed a number of times, most, prominently in the Estate of Makos case, in which there was a plurality opinion from this court in which that particular medical malpractice statute of repose was found to be unconstitutional as it applied to that particular plaintiff who, in a situation similar to this, had her claim expire or be barred by the statute of repose before it ever could have been discovered, before she ever could have done anything about it. And I think those similar considerations impact here, and I would agree.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsey. Justice Press.
The pleural thickening was diagnosed in the late 70s or early 80s, is that right?
That's correct.
But Mr. Sofa continued working until sometime in 1995.
Correct. He continued working until he retired in 1995.
Is it your position that all those years of work after the initial lawsuit contributed nothing to his ultimate condition?
That's correct, for two reasons. Number one, he likely encountered no exposure after that point in time, or very, very minimal exposure, because as I indicated, asbestos was not used in insulation products beyond 1973-74. So he wasn't exposed in the late 70s or 80s, other than perhaps some occasional exposure to existing insulation. Secondly, the disease of mesothelioma has a 30-year latency period. So a diagnosis in 1996 means that the causative exposure occurred in the 1960s or 1950s, not in the 1980s. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Will of Foley & Lardner, representing Owens Corning Fiberglass Corporation.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Trevor Will. I actually represent five of the defendants' respondents: Pittsburgh Corning Corporation, Armstrong World Industries, GAF, Asbestos Claims Management Corporation, and AmChem. I am making the argument on behalf of all of them by consent of other parties. This afternoon, what I intend to show is that this is not a discovery rule case, that the well-settled prohibition against claim splitting is the rule that applies here, that there is no principled basis for distinguishing the rule that Mr. Ranta advocates for asbestos cases from any other type of latent damage that appears in any other type of tort case, and that upon close examination, the rule against claim splitting is in fact beneficial and should be retained and applied here, and Judge Nickel should be affirmed. Starting with why this is not a discovery rule case and doesn't present the type of conflict that Mr. Ranta identified is if we assume, as set forth in the 1987 pleading, that in fact Mr. Sofa had been diagnosed with an asbestos-related injury, all of the factors that are at issue in the Hansen line of cases had come to pass at that point. He knew he had an injury, he knew of its connection with the defendants, and he went to court and he brought a lawsuit. That's what Hansen and the discovery rule cases are concerned with. This is concerned with something different. This is concerned with the manifestation of one item of damages, not with the accrual of a cause of action. Plaintiff really
doesn't something. Well, go ahead.
And the plaintiff really hasn't claimed otherwise here. We are talking about the same exposures on the same job sites to the same asbestos that created both the pleural thickening or the asbestosis and mesothelioma. We are talking about the same allegedly wrongful conduct of the defendants in both cases. In both instances, it's the alleged failure to put warnings on the packages. It's the alleged failure to test. It's the alleged failure to keep up with the medical literature. That information, that evidence is absolutely no different today than it would be in the 1987 suit. And historically in this state, the definition of a cause of action has been the wrongful conduct of the defendant. And the wrongful conduct of the defendant alleged in both cases is identical. And why does that matter? Well, it matters because if you say that you can have two claims for the same cause of action, you create enormous problems for yourself in administering the rule. How do you deal with litigation the first time around? How do you deal with the finding in the first case that the plaintiff was negligent, or that the defendant wasn't negligent, or that the plaintiff was exposed to or worked with a particular defendant's product? How do you handle that the second time around? If I have a jury verdict on behalf of my client, National Gypsum, which after bankruptcy is known as Asbestos Claims Management Corporation, that Mr. Sofa never worked with or around a National Gypsum asbestos-containing product, and the jury found that in 1989, why should I be hailed back into court in 1996 to relitigate the question? And yet under his proposal, I would be. I could be, and it would happen.
Well, but the cause of action does not accrue at the time of the contact with the car or your other wrongful conduct. It accrues when there's an injury.
Correct.
And his argument, if I understood it, at least in part, was there was no injury with the pleural condition because it didn't cost anything in effect.
Well, let's be clear about that, if that was his injury. There is absolutely nothing in this record, and I don't mean to demean Mr. Ranta in his statement, but there is nothing in this record that says the only thing that Mr. Sofa was diagnosed with in the late 70s or the early 80s was pleural plaques. What he alleged in his complaint was he had asbestosis, he had pulmonary fibrosis, he had severe debilitating personal injuries, he was coughing, he was in pain, and I mean, can you waltz into court and say that's the situation and then 10 years later say it wasn't? But I'll get beyond that. I'll address
it. Because that would just relate to
right.
this case, and I don't think that's why
we're here. I agree with you, and I agree with Mr. Ranta, that if all we were talking about was a diagnosis of pleural thickening that wasn't an injury, if all we were talking about was somebody said you had asbestosis, but it has absolutely no clinical manifestation, there is no cause of action accrued, the statute doesn't begin to run, you don't have this claim-splitting problem, and I would encourage this court, however you decide the issue with respect to Judge Nichols' decision, to make it absolutely plain to the judges and the lawyers in this state that a diagnosis of essentially asymptomatic pleural plaques or asbestosis that has no clinical manifestation or significance is not an injury that starts the statute of limitations running, because that clear holding will solve a lot of this problem.
You don't have a statute of limitations running, and you're not going to have claims exclusion either.
Exactly. And then, and if that were really the case, if that were really what happened here, then in 1996, when the mesothelioma is diagnosed, and Mr. Silva comes into court, it's the first time he's been here, there's no issue that he had a claim before. But unfortunately, in this case, we've got an allegation that he was really injured in 87, and on that basis, that the lawsuit proceeded, the defendants were sued, they incurred expenses, he was dismissed on the merits and with prejudice. And what does that mean? It means that the allegations about the wrongful conduct of the defendant were dismissed. That conduct is now beyond the pale. We're not going to go back and revisit it, and yet the rule he suggests would do that. The flip side of this is, and I think it's important to talk about this as well, that the other cases from the other jurisdictions talk about it's a better rule to let people come back. It's more fair. Now, you'll notice that none of those cases analyze in detail how you actually apply such a rule. They don't talk about what you do with prior findings. They don't talk about some of those issues. They don't talk about how many times can you sue for punitive damages. And what they say is they basically advance four rationales for why it's a better rule. And the first one is that it eliminates premature or anticipatory or speculative suits. Well, I would suggest two things about that. First, the clear pronouncement that a diagnosis of plaques without actual impairment will eliminate anticipatory suits. But the second thing is, in those states that haven't been careful to do that, what they've actually done is created a gold rush to the courthouse. Because now every time an individual gets diagnosed with what can be alleged to be a slightly different condition, they can go in and file a lawsuit and ask for money. And, for example, in the city of Baltimore, there are over 10,000 cases pending. Because Baltimore adopted this come back as often as you want to situation.
Just for asbestos.
Just for asbestos. Right. So if you were going to go down the road that Mr. Ranta proposes, in order to eliminate these suits, you'd have to say, as you said before, that you can't sue for asymptomatic plaques, that you can't sue for medical monitoring, that you can't sue for emotional distress and worrying about the future, that you really don't have any claim when you've got a diagnosis of a plaque. That's the first one, and I suggest that rationale really doesn't apply unless you put all these bells and whistles. The second question is, or the second reason advocated for carving out this exception, is that there's supposedly a better fit with the damages. The damages won't be speculative. People won't be guessing. Well, again, that's only true if the court, in effect, adopts or pronounces a code for how you handle these cases. For example, in 1986 or 1987, Mr. Sofa sued for wage loss. Let's change the facts a little bit, and let's assume that he really had severe asbestosis and was confined to a wheelchair and had to retire, and did have legitimate wage loss. And again, change the facts a little bit and assume that when he got the mesothelioma, he was still at working age. Now, how do you handle the fact that both cases would seek recovery for wage loss? How do you handle the fact that both cases would seek recovery for the wife's loss of consortium? How do you handle the fact that in the first lawsuit, there's going to be a claim for future medical expenses extending out over his life, and now he gets cancer and dies, and maybe his medical expenses are far less than were awarded the first time? These are all issues that these other cases haven't dealt with. And they suggest, and Justice Bradley, you were raising the workers' compensation issue again, and it couldn't help but cross my mind that is a legislative scheme designed with a whole set of rules enacted by the legislature after input from the various constituencies. And it's not designed for finality, but it's designed to let people come back as their situation changes. If you want that kind of a system, I don't think institutionally, this court is the institution to hear from those constituencies, to gather the facts, to find out how serious a problem is this, and what's the best way to deal with it. So that's the reason I say that the better fit for damages really doesn't hold water upon analysis unless you put all these bells and whistles on it. The third issue is that it eliminates the problem of a particular plaintiff being unable to recover a particular item of damage because it doesn't occur at the point when the lawsuit is going on. And that's true. But the question is, what's the cost for doing it? And in this case, the situation that Mr. Sofa faced is really no different than the situation faced in all sorts of other situations. And Justice Abramson, you were wondering about some other examples, and I thought of a couple sitting there. Smoking litigation is now on the horizon. Somebody gets diagnosed with chronic bronchitis because they're a smoker. 5 years later, they get diagnosed with emphysema because they're a smoker. 6 years after that, it's lung cancer. They get three lawsuits. Every one of those is a medically distinct disease process. Contracting one doesn't predispose you or determine that you'll get the other. Contracting the first one doesn't determine that you will get any of the others. There isn't any principled basis to cabin this exception for asbestos. And once you let it loose, you undo this whole system of law that we have in the state.
Well, taking your example, why shouldn't a plaintiff find that he is injured by cigarette smoking? Has bronchitis, be allowed to sue, and then late, 10 years later discovers something else? Why shouldn't he be allowed to bring that?
Reason
we've never allowed it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
All right. The reasons are that there are policy factors that weigh in favor of adopting this, and I, rather than calling it a single injury, because it really isn't a single injury, it's all injuries from the same cause of action rule. Number one is finality and repose. There is an interest in putting these issues to bed and not repetitively burdening defendants, insurers, plaintiffs, witnesses with relitigation over and over and over again over the same set of facts.
Well, that's certainly stating it from the defendant's point of view. But from the plaintiff's point of view, when he got bronchitis, he didn't know he was going to get lung cancer. When he got lung cancer, he didn't know he was going to get something else.
You're absolutely right about that. And I'm just saying, institutionally, the values that have been identified as justifying the single cause of action rule are, number one, finality and repose.
Well, that rule came up under circumstances, I think, where you know or should have known all of your damages. So they didn't want you to isolate your damage to your real estate in one lawsuit, your damage to your personal property in a second lawsuit, and personal injury damage in a third lawsuit, where you knew within a short time of all three. They said, don't split it up, right?
Or even your personal injuries.
Yeah, a personal injury in terms of loss of consortium in one lawsuit and your leg in another, and et cetera. But this is a very different fact situation from that. Here, you have to assume you don't know. So it's not like you know and you're dividing it up. It's you don't know, and therefore you'll never recover.
That item of damages, that's correct. That's correct.
So the policy argument is very different than the one you have presented, because in those cases, most of them, I think, will present the situation that I've just outlined. You know your injury. You've just divided up your cause of action.
We could quibble about whether you will at most, but I agree with the point that you're making about dividing up the cause of action. But to respond to Justice Ballage, I don't think just because there was no way of knowing that mesothelioma would develop in 1989, that necessarily detracts from the repose finality issue. I mean, it weighs on the scale. It says, okay, there may be some other damages there, but people still advocate repose finality as one reason. The second reason is judicial economy. I mentioned what's happened in other states. You get just an influx of these cases that have an impact not only on other asbestos cases, but on the whole business of the docket. The third issue that I think is important is avoiding stale claims. It is not true that it is as easy to defend a case brought by Mr. Sofa in 1996 as it would have been in 1987. Witnesses are gone, witnesses die. One of the key issues is always what products and what job sites the individual worked with and around. The longer time goes by, the more that type of evidence disappears.
But again, that's through no fault of the plaintiff. The plaintiff, Mr. Sofa here, could not have discovered it because he didn't have that problem.
I understand that, but it can be a severe prejudice to the defendant, and that's one of the policy reasons that says we try to avoid stale claims. I'm not saying that, I'm just trying to, again, identify that you asked me why we have this rule.
I appreciate your answer, and okay. I'm not trying to be disrespectful.
I'm not either, I'm sorry. The last
Mr.
reason
Will,
is...
Let me interrupt at
sure,
this point. When we're talking about policy reasons to justify this rule, what about Article 1, Section 9? I know you are aware of the fact that this Court has had a vigorous discussion through several cases about the meaning of Article 1, Section 9. But what about the idea that as you weigh these policy considerations, there ought to be a remedy for a wrong? And if we take the approach that you're advocating, there's not a remedy for this plaintiff, is there?
Well, there is, and I don't want to quibble semantically with you, but the wrong, if it is wrong, is the tortious inhalation of the asbestos fibers due to the negligence of the defendants. Now, how that manifests itself in varying items of damages is a different question. The rule, the single cause of, the single injury rule, the single cause of action rule, gives a remedy to the plaintiff. It just says at a certain point there's some items of damages that you're not going to be able to recover.
But the remedy here wasn't really available because the cancer doesn't show itself until 1996.
The remedy for the cancerous element of damages wasn't available. But again, let's assume that he did have serious asbestosis as alleged in the complaint. He could have recovered for that. He could have recovered for those medical expenses. He could have recovered for those lost wages. His wife could have recovered for her loss of consortium. So it's not the situation that he's completely without any sort of remedy for a true asbestos-related injury. There's this one item of damage that may be prohibited, but that's not the same thing as saying he has no remedy at all. It may just not be as large as he would like it. And I don't think that implicates Article 1, Section 9. In fact, when this Court has held, I think the Joseph W. and the CLL Associates case being the most dramatic example, that it is not a violation of Article 1, Section 9 to have a statute of limitations run even before the defendant discovered, or could have discovered, in the case of Joseph W., Joseph W. is a horrible case in that sense. The parents know that there's something wrong with their child. They're doing everything they can to investigate and find out what the problem is, and they can't. And yet the statute ran before they even learned, and the court said, affirmed and said that that's not a constitutional violation. I suggest what we have here is significantly less onerous than what existed in that case.
When was that case?
My memory is going to fail me, but it was in the last couple of years. I suspect I can get the site here before I'm done. I think almost done with your question, Justice Ballish. And the last point really is the interrelationship of all the other rules as they relate to the trial of a lawsuit. Things like, you know, what you do with litigating it the first time versus litigating it the second time. How many times do you let punitive damages be claimed? What do you do with findings the first time? Is there an argument? Is there decided a case that was in the last year in the cryptosporidium area where he suggested it was a statutory violation to have a class action where one jury decided certain aspects of the claim and then you sent them back to separate juries to decide other items of the claim. So we have, I don't even think this is an exhaustive list, but you begin to create all sorts of rippling effects through the other rules that regulate how we deal with lawsuits if you say it's okay to come back a second time.
I'm not quite sure I understand what you would count. What should Mr. Sulfa have done starting back in the late 70s?
I'm glad you asked that question. What he should have done is this. If all he really had was pleural plaques, pleural thickening, and he wanted to be on the safe side, what he should have gone to the defendants and said, I've got this diagnosis, I'd like to enter into a tolling agreement, which are common in the business. They're called green cards. And the tolling agreement essentially says the defendant, that you won't sue us now, we won't assert the statute of limitations later, and if you develop disease to a certain extent, come in and file a lawsuit. Or what he might have done is gone over to Milwaukee. We have a judicially created, what's called a plural registry there, where people that find themselves in this circumstance, or even that have maybe a minor clinical manifestation of something, can put their name on the registry, not have to litigate the case now, and when they meet certain medical criteria, then they come off the registry, and their case goes forward as though there was no statute of limitations.
Was that all in place in the early 80s?
The green card work. Well, let me back up just a second, because I don't want to mistake that. Depending upon exactly when he was diagnosed is significant. If the initial diagnosis was before this court announced the Hansen decision in 1983, there was an argument that the statute had already run when the disease first became, quote, diagnosable. That was the Neubauer decision out of the Seventh Circuit. I think Hansen put that to rest. But once Hansen came on the scene, and certainly by the mid-80s, green cards were a common occurrence in this time with people who found themselves in this type of situation. Now, that's a private remedy, but it certainly has, it's an effective remedy. What he shouldn't have done, I suggest, is file a lawsuit alleging that he had asbestosis if he didn't really have it, alleging that he was seriously injured if he really wasn't. And
didn't he say in that lawsuit that the asbestosis was only recently discovered when he filed that suit in 1987?
Well, I don't have the complaint memorized word for word,
page 12 of the complaint, that the plaintiff's condition has recently been diagnosed with asbestosis. I don't get the sense that he was in severe pain and all of these other things right at the time the thickening, pleural thickening, was first discovered.
Well, I'm going to explain it. Just above that, it says discovered excruciating pain. Now, that's the allegation. And then he was diagnosed with asbestosis. And so the court is clear on this, the distinction between asbestosis and pleural thickening. Asbestosis is actually fibrosis in the lung itself that inhibits the gas exchange. You get all this scarring in your lungs, and they just don't work the way they're supposed to. Pleural thickening is just, it's a callus, if you will, on the lining that really doesn't affect the, or may not affect the functioning of the lungs.
Is it a necessary precondition to the cancer?
Is either one of them?
Yeah.
Certainly not pleural plaques. Mr. Rant is right about that. As to asbestosis, there's a scientific debate about whether asbestosis is a necessary precursor for lung cancer. You can find doctors who say it is. You can find others who say it isn't. Unfortunately, I guess we don't have to decide that right here because this is not a lung cancer case. Asbestosis is not a precursor to mesothelioma. I would take issue with one thing. Mesothelioma can have a latency period considerably shorter than 30 years, I'm sure that makes a lot of difference. But, I'm sorry, Justice Crosby, to get back to your question about what he should have done. And those are the answers that I can give you, nothing.
on the theory that he wasn't sick, didn't have any extraordinary expenses, or to be proactive and enter into one of these agreements. If he did nothing, then, again, I don't think we'd be here today, if Mr. Rant is correct that he really had nothing wrong with him. But because he filed a suit and because it was dismissed, we've got a different problem. I mean, those facts were judicially determined, and, or that, be more precise, the conduct of the defendant was judicially determined, and claims relating to that conduct were dismissed with prejudice. And this is another claim that relates to that conduct, and therefore it's precluded.
Mr. Will, are these tolling agreements that you've talked about, are those agreements that are not contested, that it's just automatic, you bring in your diagnosis and all of the companies will enter into the tolling agreement?
For all of the companies that I have represented and I'm aware of, yes, unless the person came in and was, you know, excruciatingly sick, but that kind of person would file a lawsuit. I'm not aware, and I've been doing this now for almost 15 years, of any instance in which somebody in this kind of situation presented with a request for a green card and were turned down.
Does the registry work the same way, basically?
Oh, the registry doesn't even require permission. Yes, anybody can enroll on the registry in Milwaukee that wants to.
And what is the result of that?
We've had, I don't remember the exact numbers, but somewhere between 70 and 100 individuals enrolled on the registry. We continue to get, one or two or three a year, and we've had, I think, one individual develop cancer, come off the registry, and file a lawsuit. And that, you know, statute of limitations is not an issue in that case.
This is the first time I have heard of that. Is this a well-known fact? Should the lawyer who represented Mr. Sopa back in 19-whatever have known this?
The answer is that the asbestos bar tends to be very specialized. And the lawyers that handle the asbestos cases from the plaintiff's side, I certainly believe know about the Milwaukee Pleural Registry because the prominent plaintiff's lawyers were the ones who entered into it, Mr. Ranton included. The lawyers that represented Mr. Sopa initially were from Michigan. One of them, but again, Art Peterson, specialized in asbestos litigation there. Henderson out of Pittsburgh has one of the well-known plaintiff's lawyers in asbestos litigation, so they certainly should have been aware of this option. Chris Walther, I think, just signed the papers to the head of Wisconsin lawyer. He's not typically a...
If you were sitting on the court and were assigned to write this opinion, what kind of opinion would you write? Just give me the outline of it.
Well, what I would first do is make it absolutely clear, as I said before, that these diagnoses of an asymptomatic plaque or a clinically insignificant diagnosis of asbestosis is not an injury that starts the limitation period running, and the plaintiff has no claim. The second thing I would do is, as it relates to this particular situation, given the fact that the lawsuit was filed in 1986 and was dismissed, I think both claim preclusion and statute of limitations apply. Now, the third thing that I would do is, as it relates to this question of do we carve up or do away with the single cause of action rule, I would say that there is not enough evidence before this court yet that this is a widespread problem, but that if there is, perhaps I would invite the legislature to take a look at that issue and to enact an entire code, if you will, that addresses some of these problems that I think we've identified. It says in what circumstances the carve-out will apply, and it says that this is how you handle the carve-out. I think that would appropriately disclose it.
Thank you.
All right. The citation, just established for the... the CLL Associates case, which it was 1993, and the Joseph W. case is 97. The last point that I guess I would like to leave the court with is that if you were to adopt this rule, you're really undoing the Nierengarten decision of last term, because in that case, when the initial diagnosis was made of the hyperactive attention deficit disorder, there wasn't any diagnosis made of the bipolar or the mathematics disease. And the court said that the... Sorry, my red light has come on.
Sorry, you may finish one sentence.
One sentence, okay.
You're authorized to make it a little long.
All right. The court said that that one item and the damages associated with it started the cause of action running for everything. The only... this rule would undo that result. New diagnosis of a new psychological condition would permit those very plaintiffs to come back into court and present a claim for additional damage.
Mr. Will, didn't Nierengarten focus on the idea of unexpected expenses?
Yes.
Wasn't that a key part of the ruling?
Yes, that until you have unexpected expenses, that's the reason why here, if you have a non-disabling pleural plaque or asbestosis with no clinical symptoms, you really don't do anything than you do otherwise, just an annual checkup. There's nothing else to do for it, there's no medication, and that's why the rule I discussed before fits perfectly within Nierengarten and Miracle, because you don't have those extraordinary expenses. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ranter.
Thank you. I'd like to address just a couple of points if I could. First of all, I have to follow up on the question posed by Justice Prosser as to what Mr. Sofa should have done in the 70s or 80s, and Mr. Will's response to that is that he said, well, he shouldn't have filed a lawsuit. I would submit we'd be here today whether or not he filed a lawsuit, because the position of the defendants is that that diagnosis of pleural disease triggered the statute of limitations for Mr. Sofa. We would be here regardless of whether he filed that suit or not. When Mr. Will was asked how he would write this opinion, he said, well, I would find that that pleural condition wasn't a disease, but Mr. Sofa is still barred by claim preclusion, which really is kind of that catch-22 again. He's barred by claim preclusion because he filed a lawsuit over something that we say is not even a disease and he couldn't have gotten any relief for, but now he's barred from filing his cancer claim because of something that wasn't even a disease at the time and he couldn't have recovered for it. It's a circular argument. To just address the situation on the plural registry and these green cards, the plural registry didn't exist in the late 1980s when Mr. Sofa filed his claim. And in fact, Mr. Sofa, as we know, got the plural condition probably in the late 70s or early 80s. By the time he filed his lawsuit in 1986, his claim was already barred by the statute of limitations, which is why he moved to voluntarily dismiss it. The plural registry simply didn't exist. It was created as a joint effort by my law firm and myself and Mr. Will to try and deal privately with a situation that we saw potentially occurring, and it was a private remedy that we created.
What about the green card?
Well, I don't think they were as easy to obtain as Mr. Will suggests. And it really creates kind of an obstacle course for these plaintiffs, is somebody, if you had a diagnosis of a pleural condition, you had to go find a lawyer who knew something about it and then had to convince the lawyer, well, go talk to these defendants and see if they'll give you a green card. And some would, some wouldn't. It wasn't a consistent policy. It was an individual thing with companies. Usually they occurred in the context of a lawsuit, where the company, as a form of settlement, would agree to this green card situation. So I don't think it was quite as easy as has been suggested, and it really created an obstacle course, and it still does for people. With respect to the Nierengarten decision that was touched upon, I agree, as Justice Crooks pointed out, that case really focused on the extraordinary expenses. But I would also suggest that that's a case where it appears from the record that that condition could have been discovered at the time of the attention deficit disorder diagnosis. Because if the court recalls from the record, both at this level and in the Court of Appeals decision, the plaintiff had submitted an affidavit from the psychiatrist in which he rendered the opinion that the child, in fact, had bipolar disorder and mathematics disorder at the time he had the attention deficit disorder. And there was a whole series of escalating behavioral problems from that child very early on, and I would suggest that in that case, that condition, set forth by the plaintiff's own psychiatrist, could have been discovered at the time of the ADD diagnosis. And so it is really a separate type of case than we have here. And finally, I would just like to leave the court with the urging that if the court has not done so already, I would really urge the court to take a look at a couple of the cases from the other jurisdictions, which really go through this whole analysis and discuss the single injury rule as it applies here and the discovery rule as it applies here, and specifically the Wilson case from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia back in 1982, the Potts case from Tennessee, and the Marinari case from Pennsylvania are three decisions I think really lay it out and go through the whole analysis and discuss the countervailing policies and then and really address in a straightforward way the choices that need to be made. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aranta. That concludes 98-1343, and the court is adjourned until September 14th.